Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me today is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hello, Teresa. Thank you.
Good to have you here today, and looks like hopefully our topic today will be a lot less gory as compared to last week's horrendous loss of life.
Yeah. Well, that's tough. The Great War is tough. On the other hand, quite honestly, the messages at Fatima are dire warnings if we don't do what we're supposed to do. And, of course, the rest of the 20th century is pretty much a lesson of what happens when we don't listen to Mother.
That's right. Must listen to Mother.
So, we're going to be talking about Fatima today. It's just a fascinating topic and some really great stuff. A little bit later on, too, I'll give some books and some different sources we can go to and that can give you more information on Our Lady of Fatima.
Great.
I just mentioned in passing, I just to find out what was out on the Internet, I just took a little Google search.
Mm-hmm.
There are 909,000 909,000 sites on Fatima. But I think one of the things that's just absolutely enormous. But the other thing, too, is it's a cautionary tale that I didn't look at all 909,000. Sorry. But undoubtedly, there's some kooks out there, too.
Oh, sure.
So it's important, I think, for us as we look at this issue that we go to reputable sources also. And so I'll give some of those a little bit later on. Good. Well, the fact of the matter is that between May 13th of 1917 and October 13th of 1917, there are monthly apparitions that take place in the tiny little village of Fatima in Portugal. And particularly, not in the town itself, but in a little cove called the Cova de Iria, which translates in English as the Cove of Irene. Which, if you remember your Greek, Irene means peace. Which is incredibly ironic because the world was not at peace at all in 1917, anything but. As we talked about last week, World War I, or the Great War, as they called it, was in its third year. Millions of men had been gobbled up in this battle. By 1917, just a matter of a couple months later, you're going to have Russia going... Well, Russia's already in chaos.
Mm-hmm.
The Bolshevik Revolution will take place in November of 1917. But as I say, Russia is already in chaos by the time the first apparition takes place. The Bolshevik Revolution is underway. 1 month earlier, in April of 1917, the United States went to war. Joined in on the Allied side, which we had mentioned last week. In a sense, that declaration of war continued the war because now the Allies were not interested in Pope Benedict XV's peace plan.
Right.
I don't know that they were much interested to begin with, but certainly after the U.S. joined the war, they were going for absolute total peace. Total victory, which is exactly what Benedict felt was the worst thing that could possibly happen, that too many men had been killed already, and that the only way to bring a peaceful 20th century would be an accord between the warring powers. Well, that didn't happen. And not only this, remember that Woodrow Wilson, the president that led us into war then in April of 1917, had run on the in the presidential campaign of 1916 on a peace ticket. His slogan was, "He kept us out of war." And that was, of course, in November. So within 6 months, we are now in the war. There are all kinds of reasons for that, of course, and historians have argued ever since as to whether the United States had a reason to be in that war. But, well, we were. That's all there is to it. And so the entire world is just full of this. So we go back then to the Cove of Peace, and what we have is a series of monthly apparitions. We have a series of prophecies. We have a solar phenomenon, which we'll talk about later, in which there were 70,000 eyewitnesses to this. That, of course, is the miracle of the sun on October 13th. But to start out with, we've got to explain a little bit why we're dealing with a Catholic miracle with a Muslim name.
Right.
You know, which is an interesting story in itself. It says a lot about Portugal. The area, the little tiny village there of Fatima, was named after an actual Moorish woman whose name was Fatima. She was named after as many Muslim girls and women are named after the daughter of Muhammad, Fatima. And this young girl, we're going back to the 1100s. There was lots of fighting going on. The Islam, the Muslims, had come out of North Africa across the Iberian Peninsula, conquered all of Spain and Portugal, crossed over the Pyrenees Mountains, had come into southern France, and it was in 711 that you have, I think it's 711, my dates in medieval history are usually pretty bad. But anyway, at the Battle of Tours and the Battle of Poitiers, the Christian forces in France rally under Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, defeat the Muslims, and who then retreat back over the mountains. And then little by little, century by century, you have the Reconquista of the Iberian Peninsula, which doesn't come to an end until 1492. So it's almost, it's over 700 years struggle. And in the middle of this, in the 1100s, there is a Portuguese force fighting against the Moorish force. They win some territory. In the midst of this uproar, a young girl, a Moorish girl, falls into the hands of the Christian army. And one of the knights in the Christian army fell madly in love with her.
Okay.
And so they married. She converted to Catholicism, and they married. And she only lived for a few years, died very young. And the knight was so distraught that he built a beautiful burial place for her. And the place was named after her.
Okay.
And so that's how we get Fatima or Fatima, named after her. He himself later was buried in the same spot.
Okay.
So the history of Portugal is the Portuguese are different from Spaniards and exerted their independence from Spain in 1385. In fact, you find two Christian bodies in the Iberian Peninsula actually going to war with each other. Spain trying to conquer Christian Portugal trying to get independence from Christian Spain. And imagine the Muslims must have been having a heyday watching this, you know. But the long and short of it was that in 1385, the Portuguese won a stunning victory. Pulled victory out of the jaws of defeat, and thereafter got an independent kingdom. And then they became allies again with the Portuguese and pushing with the Spaniards in pushing the Moors further and further south and out of Spain. In Portuguese history, it is an article of faith that particular victory that took place should not have taken place, but it did take place, and it is an article of faith among Portuguese that it was done through the intercession of the Blessed Virgin. So Portugal has always had a very strong devotion to Mary. For about 200 years after then these events, you have the Reconquista continue on and finish basically in Portugal. Portugal sort of settles down to be a nice, quiet, rural area. And then in the 1400s and 1500s, it kind of explodes onto the stage of world events. This is the time in which you have huge expansion, huge exploration lots of technical innovations, and which makes then global exploration possible.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to some of these names. Henry the Navigator.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was a prince in Portugal. If you remember your history, you remember that he was so far down. He was a prince. He was one of the son of the king, but he was so far down the line. There were so many brothers ahead of him that there was no chance he would ever become king. And so he spent his whole time building a library and encouraging explorers.
Okay.
So that's Henry the Navigator. You have Vasco da Gama, Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
Bartolomeo Diaz,
mm-hmm.
Also Portuguese. Ferdinand Magellan,
mm-hmm.
Portuguese. There are other things that happen that we're not as much aware of. Around this time, you also have somebody like Alfonso the Wise, Alfonso the Good, King of Portugal, who sends an expedition down along the west coast of Africa. They come across a great nation along the Niger River and enter into relations so that the King of the Niger and the King of Portugal actually join in a treaty, and they exchange sons of each other's royal family, so that there are Portuguese noblemen that are sent to Niger,
wow.
And the same thing, the others are sent up to Lisbon. And the idea behind that was for each of the nations to learn each other's language.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And then in the process, also conversions.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the people in Niger were converted. Unfortunately, this lasted only one generation, and the conversions didn't stick. There'll be later expeditions to Niger. But you know what we're talking about? Nigeria,
mm-hmm.
the country
mm-hmm.
of Nigeria, which is so important to us today. Another thing that was in the news just a couple years ago, about 3-4 years ago, was the terrible genocide that was taking place in East Timor.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, over in Indonesia. And a couple countries stepped in right away. The United Nations moved very slowly in trying to stop this. If you remember, the Australians sent troops in very rapidly. But even faster than the Australians were Portuguese troops. And a lot of people, and I remember talking to people, and they're going,
they have
Portugal? What do they have to do with it? Well, the reason why the people in East Timor are Catholic is because of the colonization by the Portuguese on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they really are a tremendous nation.
Hmm.
Unfortunately for the Portuguese, in the 1700s and then into the 1800s, the government came to be dominated by a clique
mm-hmm.
of Freemasons.
Mm-hmm.
The most infamous of all of these is the Marquis de Pombal, who becomes the chief advisor to the King of Portugal in 1750. And the kings are not strong enough to stand against them. And little by little, the Marquis of Pombal placed Masons in important government positions and important university positions, so that by 1755, the government of Portugal and the University of Lisbon were totally in the control of the Freemasons. And of course, they began implementing their policies, which obviously, of course, are going to be anti-Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Almost on cue, Lisbon was hit with terrible disasters. In 1755, there was an earthquake that took place on the Feast of All Saints Day.
Wow.
And 10,000 people were killed in this earthquake. Lisbon itself was reduced to rubble. And you know, you think 10,000 people all in a day or two, and actually all in a matter of a minute or so,
mm-hmm.
10,000 people, that can't happen. But it did last year. Remember this past year, what was it, on the 26th of December, I think, of 2003,
mm-hmm.
the city of Bam in Iran was leveled and and tens of thousands of people were killed or injured in just a matter of minutes there also. So this thing's happened, and it happened to Lisbon. It got worse, though. The Tagus River actually dammed up and then reversed itself, so that not only do you have an earthquake, but it's followed by a flood. And when the waters receded, fires broke out and burned down what was left of the city. Fires went on for 6 days before they could put them out.
Wow.
Just a terrible disaster. In 1759, the Marquis de Pombal succeeded in getting the Jesuits expelled from Portugal. And he did this on some trumped-up charges. There had been an assassination attempt against the king, and he convinced the king that it was a Jesuit plot. And so they were able to throw the Jesuits out of Portugal. The real reason behind that actually is for revenge sake.
Mm-hmm.
The Jesuits had interceded in Latin America for the Native Americans there, for the Indian population in Latin America. This whole incident has been made famous by the movie The Mission.
Oh, right.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
With Jeremy Irons? And this is an actual event that took place, and the Jesuits had interceded for these Indians against the Spanish and the Portuguese. The Spanish did not have slavery at that time. The Portuguese did, and they were raiding into this Indian territory to take them as slaves. And the Jesuits had succeeded in stopping them until eventually their mission was shut down. But this was a way of getting even with the Jesuits by kicking them out of Portugal. And of course, the history is such that the same thing would take place in country after country.
Mm-hmm.
In 1807, the French invaded under Napoleon. You have the scourge of war coming to Portugal. They came back again in 1810, another scourge of war. In 1820, there was a Masonic revolt in the capital. Once again, the Masons took over, or attempted to take over the government. They eventually succeeded in 1826, got control of the government again, and they continued persecution of the church until 1842, when they lost control. In 1871, again, there was another revolt, a Masonic revolt, And the government came into the hands of what was known as the Republican Party. No relation to the Republican
right.
Party. But these basically were Masons, again. And they continued throughout the 19th century then to basically run Portugal, making it very difficult for the Catholic Church. And so you just have to marvel at Portuguese Catholicism. In 1908, as we come into our own century, there was an assassination, a successful assassination of the King of Portugal and his oldest son. As a result, the next king was the younger son, who happened to be pro-Masonic.
Mm.
And so again, if we come into the 20th century, we find more influence with in Portugal. In 1910, he was overthrown. He wasn't Masonic enough. And they established a republic of sorts under the leadership of Teofilo Braga. It's kind of interesting. His name is Teofila. It's Portuguese for Theophilus.
Uh-huh.
His mother obviously had misnamed him, the lover of God.
Right.
Anything but. In 1911, 1 year after he took over, Braga had passed in the parliament in Portugal what's called the Law of Separation of Church and State. And this is a very severe separation, far more than the wall of separation that we have in the United States. For one thing, he begins right away by legalizing and legitimizing divorce.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the beginning. The next step was that all weddings in Portugal must be done in a secular court. Well, you know, we have sort of a dual situation here mm-hmm. in the United States where religious ministers both act as a state representative as well as a religious representative, so that at a wedding mass, for instance, the priest presides over the sacrament, which mm-hmm. of course we know theologically is conducted by the man and the woman.
Couple. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but from the eyes of the state, he then is marrying them, and we have our own obligations. Within 10 days, we've got to turn that in, or we can be fined or arrested or whatever. To read the backside of a wedding document, and from a clergy's point of view, it's a little daunting. You don't want to play around with this. And but in Portugal, they outlawed Catholic marriages.
Wow.
You are not allowed to have a Catholic wedding. They also legitimized illegitimacy.
That
sounds strange, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Basically, what they're doing is they are denigrating, they're downgrading mm-hmm. the whole concept of family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
And cemeteries were secularized. All catechisms were confiscated. It was forbidden to teach catechism. One of the legislators boasted and said, and I quote here, in 2 generations, Catholicism will be completely eliminated in Portugal.
Bet not.
Yeah, right. Wouldn't want to put money on that
no
one.
No kidding.
Pope Pius X was the pope at this time, and he rejected the law of separation of church and state and basically sent Brago a letter to that effect. Brago's response was to expel all the bishops of Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Between 1912, well, both in 1912 and in 1915, there were 2 attempts to overthrow the Braga government. These were conducted by, basically, they were pro-Catholic laymen who attempted to overthrow the government. We have a similar situation here in the Western Hemisphere in the 1920s with the Cristeros movement in Mexico.
Oh, right.
You know, but so there were these attempts. I mean, you have a situation in Portugal and, of course, in Mexico, too, where you had an anti-church government in a country that was incredibly overwhelmingly Catholic.
Uh-huh.
And so the disconnect there is just pretty strong. Well, the Braga government was incredibly harsh in its suppression, not only in 1912, but in 1915 also. And I couldn't believe this until I found it in 2 different sources, and then I began to realize that this was true. The number of priests, nuns, and monks who were murdered by the Braga government in these years, the number astounded me. 17,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that something?
Oh, my goodness.
And not only that, but these radicals, would torture these priests and nuns and monks and then murder them, and they would decapitate them and walk through the streets with their heads on poles just to scare everybody. Every church in Portugal was closed down. The mass was outlawed. So was saying the rosary. That's the scene of Portugal.
Wow.
As we come into the apparitions, isn't it?
Oh,
something?
My gosh. Now, see, I didn't know all that.
Yeah.
You knew that there was tension with the government through the story of Fatima, but not like
this much.
That.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, the worst
gosh.
Had been abated by 1916. Most of the terrible abuses had settled. But this, I mean, we're talking current events when these children get this visitation. Now, I had not paid much attention to the fact that actually they had a visitation prior to 1917. I'd forgotten about this entirely, but in 1916, the 3 children who were the seers at Fatima, and we're talking, of course, about Lucia dos Santos and then her cousins, Jacinta and Francisco Marto. And the 3 of them were out shepherding. Now, all 3 of them are little children. They are uneducated. Mm-hmm. They had not gone to school. They didn't read or write. And in 1916, they report that they had seen a very bright cloud. And in this cloud there was a figure. And the figure spoke to them and said, "Do not be afraid. I am the angel of peace. Pray with me."
That's right.
And what happened was that after the experience, they went back home, and Jacinta, the little girl, told her parents of what had happened. And the whole family laughed at her, and they were ridiculed. The other two kept their mouths shut, but they were ridiculed. And then in the summer of 1916, and we only find out about this apparition much later, this appearing much later, in the summer of 1916, they were out shepherding again when the same angel appeared to them. And as they describe later on, and I keep saying later on because they did not tell anybody about this apparition. I mean, after what happened first time
around. You learn quickly.
Yeah, you do. And the angel appears holding the Eucharist and a chalice. And he says to the children, "Pray, pray very much. The holy hearts of Jesus and Mary have designs of mercy on you." It bounces a bit back to Catherine of Labouré.
Mm-hmm.
Remember her second apparition in November of 1830, and the miraculous medal. You look at the back end of the miraculous medal, you have that M with the cross, and then two hearts,
mm-hmm.
the heart of Jesus and the heart of Mary.
Right.
He then said the following, and he asked them to memorize a prayer. And they did. I think they recited it four times before they got it down. But remember, these are illiterate children, so the advantage is illiterate people tend to be better at memorizing than those of us who rely constantly on the written word.
Oh,
so they were able within four times to actually learn this. And as I say, they'll say this prayer often themselves, but then later when Lucia mm-hmm. learned how to read and write, she wrote all of this down. It goes like this. "Most Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, I offer you the most precious body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, present in all the tabernacles of the world, in reparation for the sacrileges, outrages, and indifferences by which he himself is offended, and through the infinite merits of his most sacred heart and the immaculate heart of Mary, I beg you the conversion of poor sinners."
Mm-hmm.
That's where that prayer came from. It's the angel of Fatima.
Prayer. Yeah.
He then, according to their own testimony later, Lucia's testimony later on, it administered communion to them.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, this was Jacinta's and Francisco's first communion.
First
communion. Yeah, and that's pretty good. You get it from an angel.
No kidding.
as I say, this story was only told much later,
mm-hmm.
After all the ridicule had settled down. But this ridicule is going to go on for a long time. It's not going to be easy for these kids.
Yeah.
Well, it's on May 13th of 1917. Now, these two events took place in 1916.
Mm-hmm.
In 1917, on May 13th, once again they see another apparition. This time it's a beautiful woman, very bright. And she tells them, "I am of heaven." And then asks them to come back to the same spot for 6 months, always on the 13th of the month. She asked them also to say the rosary daily for peace. And she also asked them this question, "Are you willing to suffer?"
Mm-hmm.
And each of the children said yes, they were. And the suffering began almost immediately. First from the families, and then also from the town priest.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to understand it from their point of view, and especially I'm thinking about this priest. The last thing he wants to do, and he sort of reminds you a bit of Father Pembel up in Lourdes, you know, he doesn't want to draw attention. But he's got real reason not to draw attention.
Right.
I mean, you know, he's got
a lot
of...
his head carried down the street.
Got it, yeah. So he's very happy to have this little truce between the government and the church. Just let us live our lives quietly. And then these kids come home and they start all these stories, getting everybody all riled up. This is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
We know for a fact that Lucia was maltreated back at home. Not treated very nicely in all this. But the fact is that the word spread very rapidly that something was going on in the COVID area. And so on the 13th of June of 1917, there was a considerable crowd mm-hmm. that had come to this spot. Now, the children went up to a little tree that was growing there. It's a home tree. This is the tree that these grow wild all over Portugal and in parts of Spain also, and they're the trees that you take the trunk the bark off the trunk, and that's where cark comes from.
Oh,
you know, like
okay.
For putting cark in bottles
uh-huh.
or uh-huh. going fishing or whatever.
Okay.
They're basically cark trees. And so they came up to this a home tree and they knelt down and began praying before this tree. Now, take it for what it's worth, but I did come across some recordings of observers who were there on that time, and they claim that they saw the branches bent slightly. And there are also others who didn't see that, but also claim that they heard soft murmurs. Take it for what it's worth. Others dispute that and say, no, there was nothing there. But anyway, that's the event on June. On July 13th, Mary gives them this message to ask everyone to say the rosary to bring an end to the war. And then she also said that in October she would reveal more, including her name and a wish. And she said that there would be a miracle for all to see and believe. This would happen in October. She also at this time, this is the July apparition, gave them a very brief glimpse of hell.
Oh, that was in the July?
This is the July one,
mm-hmm.
Which scared the bejeebers
mm-hmm.
out of them. I think it was Lucia who had later said that it only lasted a very brief time, and it had gone much longer, she would have died of fright. And Mary also gives this warning. This is in the July. And she said this, "The war is going to end, but if people do not cease offending God, a worse one will break out in the reign of Pius XI. Now, this is 1917. The Pope, of course, is Benedict XV.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew that he would die within 3 years. No one knew that Cardinal Ratti would take the title Pius XI certainly didn't know that he would be, you know, taking this name. And so you just, you know, it's just kind of a phenomenon. Interestingly enough, I'm going to show you that this prediction is seemingly off, because the war begins under the reign of Pius the XII.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we'll talk about that in a minute. And then goes on to say this. This is one other prediction that she has. This is July, and July 13th, and she says this, and I quote, "When you see a night illumined by an unknown light, know that this is a great sign given by God that he is about to punish the world for its crimes by means of war, famine, and persecution of the church and the Holy Father."
Okay.
So this is another prediction, another prophecy, that there's going to be some kind of an unknown light in the night that is going to be a precursor of a coming horrible war. Well, you can go to secular history, and or you could go to the chronicles of astrophysics. And we know for a fact that on the night of January, the 25th, 26th of 1938, there was a phenomenon in the sky over Europe. It was a aurora borealis, and it went over the Western Hemisphere. Now, these things are usually not in that far south.
Right.
It's something that you'd see, you know, in the North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But this actually appeared, and it's recorded in the history of the Third Reich. This happens in 1938. Adolf Hitler was on the porch of a villa. That night, he and all the big muckamucks, you know, Goering and Goebbels and Himmler and all of them, of an evening, and they walked outside to watch this phenomenon, and the witnesses who saw this said that their faces, the faces of these Nazis who were about to bring war upon and death and destruction upon the world, that all their faces glowed red, and they had an eerie look as they looked at each other, and it was a look of anticipation, of being scared, and at the same time a certain smile on their face of a precursing of their destiny. Whoa, it's enough to give you the willies.
It
isn't
does
it?
Give me the willies.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh!
And in World War II, of course, we always date World War II as starting in September 1st of 1939. This event takes place in January of 1938. So we see that, you know, the war itself starts with the invasion of Poland, the military invasion of Poland. Pius IX dies on April 10th of 1939. So let's just set this up chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
The Aurora Borealis takes place in January of 1938.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope dies in April of 1939. The war begins in September of 1939. It seems as though Mary is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she said that the war would begin during the reign of Pope Pius IX. The inconsistency probably, as I'm looking at the events, probably is that she doesn't think that World War II began on September 1st.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she thinks World War II began with the Nazi invasion of Czechoslovakia, which did not precipitate military action. If you remember your history, what happened was the great powers were about to go to war, and Britain and France persuaded Hitler not to go to war, and they met in Munich at the Munich conference, and there they promised to hand over, to allow Hitler to have certain portions of Czechoslovakia, the area called the Sudetenland, if he promised not to go to war. And if you remember, this is Neville Chamberlain comes back to England with a little piece of paper at the airport. He holds it up and he says, "This is peace in our time."
Mm.
Now, and then, of course, immediately afterwards, then the German armies marched into the Sudetenland but didn't stop. They continued all the way on and conquered all of Czechoslovakia without a shot. And perhaps mm-hmm. Mary knows a little bit more than we do
mm-hmm.
about what causes
the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, that's that inconsistency. She also has a message concerning Russia. And she says the following: "If my requests are heeded, Russia will be converted and there will be peace. If not, she will spread her errors throughout the world, causing wars and persecutions of the church." Now, what these kids knew of Russia, living over in Portugal, probably never seen an atlas in their life,
mm-hmm.
never gone to school, you know, what would they know about this? But if they had been up on current events in Russia, they would see that Russia was already in chaos. As I'd mentioned before, the Russians had lost two very important battles against the German army, the one of Tannenberg and the other at Masurian Lakes. They suffered 2 million casualties in these battles.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Dead, wounded, and captured, actually huge numbers captured. Massive numbers of Russian soldiers simply stopped fighting and walked over to the German side. And it's the first use of, you know, we have weapons of mass destruction. This would be a weapon of mass enticement, I guess you could say, because the German army, I'd mentioned to you last time around, moved so quickly they had to put their kitchens on mobile.
Right, and wheels to
wheels,
them.
Yeah. Well, in this particular case, in the Battle of Masurian Lake, many of the kitchens had gotten faster than they were supposed to have, and so they were closer to the combat lines than what they were supposed to have, and a strong wind came out of the west, and this smell of German cooking wafted over the battlefield.
Russians.
And the Russians had not eaten for 2 days.
Oh.
They couldn't keep their supplies up. And so just massive numbers, I mean, tens of thousands, simply put down their weapons and marched across to the German side.
Wow.
I knew of one man, I knew him many years ago, who had had the experience. He was a Russian Cossack. And during World War I, he and his light cavalry unit were sent to attack German machine gun positions. And each time they were just mowed down and retreated back. And on the third or I think it was the fourth time, the Russian officer sent them forward again. And this time what they did was they charged the German lines right before they reached the outer range of the machine guns. They wielded to the right, okay, and they charged off the battlefield and kept going, the whole group of them kept going all the way up to Lithuania.
Oh, my gosh.
Where they got rid of their uniforms, hopped on ships, and went over to England.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
wow.
You know, it's just, and so things just get worse and worse for the Russians. By March 8th of 1917, in other words, a month before the first apparition, you have food riots in Petrograd, which is St. Petersburg, of course. You have a Duma committee, a legislative committee that sets up a republic. The Tsar abdicates. There is cooperation with the Duma, on the one hand, with the Petrograd Soviet, which is a communist group. The two of them are trying to form a common government. Alexander Kerensky is elected president. In mid-April, just around the same time of the first apparition, Lenin returns, Vladimir Lenin. There's a revolt, a defeat. He flees to Finland. He eventually comes back. And then, of course, the Great Revolution takes place on the 6th and 7th of November of 1917, less than 1 month after the last apparition. What happens then, of course, is that Russia goes into a terrible civil war between white Russians and red Russians, and the sad history of communism. If you look at just the Catholic casualties, just the Catholic casualties, I'm not talking about all the others, but just the Catholic casualties as a result of the communist revolution, 1.6 million Catholics in Russia were either deported or murdered. By 1954, the statistic I came across, and 54 is an important date because of the Hungarian revolt. But by 1954, they counted the loss of 15,700 priests, 8,334 seminaries were closed and confiscated, 1,600 monasteries were taken over, and 31,779 churches. Ultimately, Lenin, during the short time that he was the big enchilada of the Soviet Union, had resulted in the total deaths of 20 million people. Joseph Stalin, the time that he was in power, 46 million people died under this man. And you go, my goodness gracious, I can't believe this.
Is there anybody left? Yeah.
Is there anybody left? But then when you take a look at communist China, Mao Zedong had led to the death of 70 million people. This is absolutely phenomenal. When we take a look also at her her prediction, her prophecy of the Holy Father's suffering, I want to take a little look at that also. It's one after another. Benedict XV, the present pope at the time of the apparitions, was hated. We talked about that last week, hated and ignored. In World War II, Pius XII was in just terrible shape, and then after the war was attacked by revisionist historians and blamed for the war, blamed for Holocaust. We'll talk about this a little bit later on, but my Lord, the incredible attacks on him. I don't know enough about John the 23rd to know how he suffered as Pope or whether he did, but certainly, you have Paul the VI, who suffered grievously in the post-Vatican era. The terrible reception of Humanae Vitae by so many people, theologians that he had trusted, that he had helped, and then to be stabbed in the back. And then, of course, John Paul II. And particularly, we zero in on one day in 1981 when he was shot. Remember, in front of the St. Peter's itself by Mehmet Ali Agca. And here we have a Turk who was operating, we know for a fact, operating under the aid of the Bulgarian secret police. And there are good possibilities, that this was done on the behest of the KGB, the Soviet secret police. May 13th,
mm-hmm.
Right? The anniversary of the first apparition. In fact, the Holy Father himself says, and I quote here, "It was a mother's hand that guided the bullet's path, and in his throes the Pope halted at the threshold of death." By the way, this is the second time in his life that he came very close to being shot to death. When he was a 13-year-old boy, back in his hometown, one of his friends was playing with a policeman's gun, and it went off, and the bullet literally missed him by inches. When he was recovered enough on July 18th of 1981, Pope John Paul II asked for two envelopes to be delivered to him from the Vatican, from the secret archives of the Holy Office, and one was white and the other was orange, and one of those contained a message that was written in Portuguese. And the other, I believe the white one, was in an Italian translation. This is, of course, the famous third secret.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular document had been placed in the secret archives of the Holy Office in 1957 as a gift from the Bishop of Liria, which is the local diocese of Fatima, for safekeeping. It had been in his possession since January of 1944, when Sister Lucia had written this document and then given it to him. This document, as I say, had been in the hands then of the Vatican since 1957. John the 23rd did not read it. He was asked if he wanted to, and he said no. Paul the 6th read it and then had it put back. And now it's in the hands of a Pope who had just come within a breath of being assassinated. The full coverage of this, to have a full sense of what this is all about, I'd really recommend. Remember I mentioned about be careful of web pages?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's a good web page. It's called The Message of Fatima. It's a document that is produced by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it was assembled by Archbishop Bertoni. Okay? And at the end of it is a complete theological commentary by Cardinal Ratzinger. And I would just recommend to any of our listeners, if they want to get the skinny on this, to go to that website and get the real document. It's about 30 or 35 pages long, but it's a fascinating read, and it has photographs of the actual documents. And the let me give you the website.
Yes,
okay.
Please.
It's www.ewtn.com. Okay, you do a backslash and put in Fatima.
Okay.
Backslash apparitions. Backslash third, T-H-I-R-D, then an underscore secret, S-E-C-R-E-T, backslash Fatima, period, H-T-M.
Okay.
And, of course, this is not the end of the story as far as the Pope is concerned. The very next year, when he goes to Fatima in May, It's actually on the 12th of May of 1982. There's another assassination attempt against him. A man with a knife tries to get to him, and of course his guards are able to protect him at that point. So, you know, he's almost attacked in that way. In 1995, there's another attempt on his life when he visited the Philippines for the World Youth Day. And the guy that was going to do this is a real professional. His name is Ramzi Youssef. And we know him as being an operative with Al-Qaeda. It was shortly before the Pope's visit that there was a fire in an apartment. A kitchen had caught on fire, and the firefighters had arrived on the scene. They put out the fire. The occupants were not there. And before they left, the Manila police arrived, and they began noticing that in the kitchen itself was a number of ingredients that could be used to make a bomb. And so they began looking at this. They also discovered plans in that that apartment that was set up. The intention was to have 12 explosions on American 747s over the Pacific on the same time, the same day, same time. 12 explosions over the Pacific on these American ships that would be simultaneous. In this plan, they hoped to kill 4,000 people. And this plan was, of course, thwarted. This man is also the mastermind behind the World Trade Center bombings, the first one in 1993, Ramzi Youssef. There's an excellent book that describes all of this, and I'll just mention this in passing. It's by Daniel Benjamin, and it's called The Age of Sacred Terror. It's 2002, and Daniel Benjamin had been in the National Security Council for counterterrorism under President Clinton. So let's go back to 1917.
Okay.
The fourth apparition is held in August without the children. The government have arrested them, taken them into custody. 18,000 people show up when they find out that the kids aren't there. And they find out also that it was the government that had done it. They were very angry about this when suddenly there was a thunderclap. People who were there, I mean, we're talking, you know, 18,000 people. People who were there assumed that it was a government bomb because already on more than one occasion the government had gone in. Remember I told you about the little cork tree?
Yes.
They blew it up.
Oh, my gosh.
They planted dynamite around it and blew it up. So everyone assumed that that's what it was. In fact, and these people then will attest to this, that there was a white cloud that formed around the tree of this, around the trunk of this tree, and that it changed colors very radically, and that there was lots of very weird colors in the COVID area that day. It was witnessed by 18,000 people, including government spies who were there and filed reports. So we know this thing happened. On the 19th of August, the three kids had been set free by this time, and it is at that time that Mary appeared to them. She also instructed them to set up a little carrying thing, a sort of a litter, to carry a statue of Our Lady of the Rosary, and instructed them to do this. They did this, and it was the first time that there had been a procession in Portugal for 7 years.
Wow.
The police were afraid to stop it. There was so many people. In September 13th, you have the fifth apparition. Once again, the police, the government are afraid to stop this. By now, 30,000 people have shown up, and they all pulled out illegal rosaries. Around noon, the sun dimmed. It seemed as though there was an eclipse, although there is nothing recorded by astronomers to that effect. People who were there, 30,000 people, attest to the rays of the sun dancing, not up in the sky, but among the people. This is almost a Steven Spielberg kind of
really,
experience.
Exactly.
For now. And then of course, the big one is on October 13th. This is the sixth apparition, the last apparition. It had been raining all night long. There had been a rare storm that had come in from Siberia. Normally, the weather of Europe goes from west to east.
Sure.
Very rarely do you have an east to west move. This happened from east to west. On the western front, they report ice storms having happened. 50,000 people show up at Fatima. Umbrellas absolutely everywhere. Total mud, pools of water, no sanitation facilities. The people are angry. The government is angry. The atheists are scoffing. By noon, nothing has happened. And so people began cackling and howling, and the three kids just felt absolutely terrible when Lucia looks up to the sky and says, "Look at the sun." All of a sudden, everything dries. We have photographs. We don't have photographs of the sun, but we do have journalists with photographs showing 50,000 people with 50,000 umbrellas. The next picture, all the umbrellas are down, and everyone's looking up, gawking. We have the photographs, and we can see this. The sun danced, literally, rolled, whirled. There were screams. As I say, lots of photographs. The question is, you know, a lot of people would say, well, this was mass hysteria. But the reality is that people reported this event, this solar event, 30 miles away that had no connection with the apparition itself. What happens is that almost immediately afterwards, the government in Lisbon calls off its Kulturkampf against religion. By 1920, there is a beautiful statue that is erected to the Blessed Virgin in the COVID area. Okay. Jacinta and Francisco will die in 1920 as a result of the influenza, which spread throughout the world, killing 20 million people. And, of course, it's in 1923 that Lucia joins a religious order, switches over to the Carmelites, and then learns to read and write, and ultimately writes the events down. It's only her superior, and then later the bishop, who has knowledge of this. And in 1930, then, the bishop declares the apparition to be worthy of belief. In 1935, the bodies of Francisco and Jacinta were exhumed. Francisco had decayed. Jacinta had not. Her body is preserved. And in 1950, it was exhumed once again. And again, it is still preserved at that point. But the bottom line in all of this is that in the 20th century, historians guesstimate that 150 million people died.
Wow.
From wars, famines, disease, the whole works. And the question is whether we have ever learned that lesson that the angel gave to these children in 1916. He had three words for them. Penance, penance, penance.
Penance.
That's something.
Fitting place to end today, Father.
Ooh, yeah.
Thank you, Father. Can we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Okay, let's say the Hail Mary.
All right.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen.